This is an AMI podcast.
Hey, Dave Brown here. If you enjoy this podcast portion of our show, remember you can watch it live every day at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. It's Friday, March the 24th, 2023. Coming up in the second hour of the show, Michael McNeely has a film review of the science fiction, climate fiction movie Vesper. And the week wraps up with some news from the literature world. Karen McKay from the Center for Equitable Library Access will stop by to highlight the Lambda Literary Awards and a couple new additions to Sela's collection. Always fun catching up with Karen on a Friday. But the hour begins with Brock Richardson and a sports chat. Brock, it's an exciting weekend in the center of the universe in Toronto, Ontario, as the Canadian Blind Hockey National Tournament gets underway with oh so much action today, tomorrow, and Sunday.
Yes, indeed. So if we are going to, let's remember that there are games from about 9 a.m. or so every day this weekend till about 6 p.m. or so every day this weekend. With the exception of Sunday, I think they close out a little bit. But if we look at the Canada-US series, so 11 a.m. today, Eastern Time, 3 p.m. tomorrow, Eastern Time as well, and 9 a.m. on Sunday. If you can't catch any of those games live, go to Parasport TV, and Nico Cardarelli and his gang will have the action there for you. And let me just tell you, Dave, when I did my first Canadian Blind Hockey championship 4 years ago now, I remember being very eyes wide open for a couple of reasons. Number one is that I was at the Mattamy Athletic Center, formerly known as Maple Leaf Gardens. And as a Leaf fan, that was kind of cool for me. Number two, my perception of blind hockey going into it, I did not know what to expect. And so it was kind of like, I wonder if this is going, what this is going to look like, how this is going to be. And I'm telling you, whatever your perception is of blind hockey, go in there with an open mind, because you are going to be amazed, blown away. And I hate to use this word, but I'm going to in this instance, you're going to be inspired, because it really is great competitive hockey from start to finish.
Yeah, I'm not trying to top your bona fides here, Brock, but I've been with this tournament pretty much since day one. I was at their 2012 Quebec City tournament. Pretty humble beginnings, probably about 20-something players, only two teams, only a couple games start the weekend. Everybody had a great time, and it was wonderful, but I've been watching this sport grow from the front row for over a decade now. Luca DeMontis, who's one of their top executives at Canadian Blind Hockey, was on the show on Wednesday. In fact, we've shared that interview on our YouTube channel as well, if folks want to check that one out. They're talking about a big picture for this sport right now, whether it be developing the grassroots all across Canada or developing international partnerships as well. Teams and players coming over from Finland this weekend to be part of the tournament. I know they were doing some development in Russia up until recently. Some geopolitics impacted that one. But England, we know England's been working on some of their development of the game. You've also seen a lot of growth in the United States. Both USA Hockey as well as para hockey in the US have taken blind hockey under their mantle. You've also seen NHL teams partnering with blind hockey across the league. So the way in which this sport is growing, it's been quite rapid over the course of a decade, and you can really see the dividends being paid out on the ice. In this Canada-America series, you're going to be seeing some very elite hockey this weekend, but even some of this grassroots stuff, some of these young up-and-comers, they're bringing a level of play as well that's really, really impressive. So it's a huge testament to the players on the ice. It's a huge testament to the local coaches and trainers and volunteers and organizations, and it's a huge testament to the guys working in the head offices who have been growing and developing and working tirelessly to put the seed of blind hockey in as many places of soil as possible.
And you know what? The thing I really love about this event, and now that it's grown to what it is I love the fact that they put the Canada-US series in the mix of all of the rest of it, the youth division, the development division, all that. Because a lot of the times, Dave, we see events like this where the national team is over there and the rest of us are just aspiring to be there. It is front and center, the Canada-US rivalry series. And so it gives an opportunity to those that are trying to aspire to be there to literally look with their own self and say, this is where I want to be. This is where I want to get to. And I think they do a tremendous, tremendous job on that. And if you haven't checked it out, do check out my recent interview with Nico Cardarelli, which is on the most recent edition of the Neutral Zone, as I promoted earlier in the week. But we talk about this very thing. And I just think everybody at Canadian Blind Hockey deserves a ton of credit for how they've designed this thing for the best and for the best of all athletes. And it's not just, oh, this is our national team and this is what we do. It's everybody all across the board that they shine such a bright light on, and I very much appreciate that.
Brock, I don't know about you, but my Facebook has been loaded the last couple days with players making their way from all across the country into Toronto. I'm like, oh man, maybe I do need to go down to the Mattamy Center this weekend and say hello to some people who I've been liking posts of all week.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing event, and I strongly suggest that even if you have gone down, go down again, because you're going to see the growth of the game has just been tremendous, and you're going to be treated to a wonderful time.
And tickets are absolutely free. So if someone does want to go attend in person, there's no cost for you to do so. It'll only cost you if you want to buy a Coke or a hot dog to watch the games and engage in some of the community around that. So it's going to be a really fun weekend at the Mattamy Center in downtown Toronto, the old Maple Leaf Gardens on top of a Loblaws. But there's a sort of special entrance you go to around Ryerson University. But have a peek at that one. Mattamy Center, really, really cool opportunity this weekend. Best of luck to all the athletes competing. And we'll talk to one of our community reporters, Blaine Deutscher, who's down there this weekend. He'll share his experience on the show next week. Brock, I made an offhand remark about Russia and Belarus. Well, there is a little bit of news out of the hockey world in those two countries. The International Ice Hockey Federation, the IIHF, is keeping their ban in place on those two countries for any international competitions governed by the IIHF over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I'm okay with this decision. I think that we're going to see this trickle down to different federations as time progresses through this. I think that the International Ice Hockey Federation has made their decision, whether we like it for good, bad, or indifferent. This is the decision they've made. And I think now we really have to begin to watch for the Olympics and Paralympic Games in a couple of years. But this is the first one where we've seen the axe sort of continue to drop on the situation. And we now know that they'll be banned for the next couple of years. And I'm okay with it.
Brock, let's look ahead to happier things. A busy weekend in sports. You've got one basketball game in mind. I've got a different one. You're thinking about the Toronto Raptors and the lowly Detroit Pistons. I'm thinking about a playoff battle tonight, just after 10 p.m. Eastern time, between the Los Angeles Lakers and Oklahoma City Thunder. That Western playoff race, my friend, there are seven teams competing for five spots that are separated by two games in the standings. It's going to be a wild ride down the finish, and the Lakers and Thunder right now tied, and whoever loses tonight falls out of a playoff spot.
Yes, that would be a probably more compelling game to watch, although the Raptors are compelling for the wrong reasons right now. I would say to you, Dave, they have three games left on this four game homestand, and I would say they need to win all three of these games. This is a team that either needs to put up or shut up, because they did not play very well against the Indiana Pacers the other night, and they just got to be better. And so let's see if they can do well. Again, the sort of storyline that continues to be is the Detroit Pistons play really well against the Toronto Raptors for no other reason than Dwayne Casey still having a personal vendetta against the team, I think, and he gets his team to play well. But yeah, the one you preview is the better one to watch. We'll see if I'm up that late tonight to watch it. But yeah, it is. So that's my basketball pick for today.
The Pistons have my favorite young player in the league. Their center, Jalen Duren, was a product of the University of Memphis. He's not an oversized center, but he's wildly athletic. One of my favorite young players to watch. I don't think he's going to win Rookie of the Year, but he does deserve some consideration. So that's one reason to tune in tonight and watch that game. Brock, we got to be quick on this, but give me a sense of what's happening with the Women's Curling Championships, the World Championships going on. Where does Canada stand going into the weekends?
7-4 as we sit here. They are currently playing a game against Denmark as we're talking about this live. They need to win that game to have a hope to clinch that one or two spot, and then hope that Sweden loses one of their two final games. And then if they do that, they'll be in the 1-2 spot. If they don't, they'll be in that mess of 3-6. It's looking well that they're going to make the playoff, but where they fit remains to be seen.
All right, Brock, one more here from the hockey world. I'm going to force you into a binary. Tomorrow night, 7 p.m. Eastern time, are you watching the Boston Bruins and Tampa Bay Lightning, or are you watching the Carolina Hurricanes and the Toronto Maple Leafs?
Tell you exactly what I'm doing. I am probably going to have one just how reasons of those two games, but yeah, those are the two marquee NHL games this weekend on Saturday.
In painting that picture, you forgot to describe your angry wife sitting next to you, but we'll deal with that on Monday. Brock, thank you for this, man. Have a great weekend.
You just reminded me she'll be angry with me. Thank you.
I think you already knew. That's Brock Richardson. He's at the AMI Sports Desk. Alex Smythe is at the AMI Weather Desk.
Here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada, starting off in Cornerbrook, Newfoundland, where there it is cloudy with a chance of snow today. There's also wind gusts up to 50 kilometers per hour. The high is -2, feeling like -13. In Charlottetown, PEI, up to 2 centimeters of snow is expected to fall today. There's a high of 1 degree with a wind chill that makes it feel like -8. In St. John, New Brunswick, it's mainly cloudy with a chance of rain today, and +4 is the high. Over to Quebec City, Quebec, it's a mix of sun and clouds, a high of +3 with a wind chill of -9, and a storm surge warning is in effect for the area. Near Toronto, Ontario, it is mainly sunny today, a high of +7, but a wind chill of -7. In Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, it's sunny, a high of +4, but there is a wind chill that makes it feel more like -20 today. That cold weather continues as we move our way over to Brandon, Manitoba, where it's mainly sunny as well. A high of -1, but feeling like -24 with that wind chill. In Regina, Saskatchewan, it's a heavy fog this morning, but they'll be dissipating in the morning and becoming mainly sunny in the afternoon. The high is -3, but that wind chill again makes it feel like -22 today. In Lethbridge, Alberta, it's a mix of sun and clouds, becoming cloudy as the morning goes on, and the high is 6 degrees today. In Red Deer, Alberta, it's cloudy with a chance of snow in the forecast. White Horse, high of clay and sunny today, depending on your location, and the high is 9 degrees. And that's your AMI National Weather Report from
Google.
Google opts Bing AI.
Google also wants you to think of Bard as like complementary to search. So once it's integrated, Bard brings home the point this is still experimental. My sense is that ultimately we will see Google try to integrate this chat interface into a search page, but it's still considering how to do so.
With Tech Trends, I'm Mike Dubosky, ABC News.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Entertainment critic Michael McNeely wants to offer up some thoughts with a review of the science fiction movie Vesper. Hey, good morning, Michael.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, Michael. This is a movie that absolutely slipped by my radar. What is Vesper about?
Well, it's a little bit complicated, so bear with me. Vesper is a 13-year-old girl, and she's living in a post-apocalyptic world. that became that way as a result of ecological change and genetic modifications gone amok. Ultimately, Vesper lives with her father, who has a disability, but is still able to communicate with her through a drone, which I really appreciated. And both daughter and father must find ways to survive and to make do with the world that they're currently in. So Vesper really has a passion for biohacking, and she wants to, again, revisit the genetic modifications that caused the world to end in the first place, but also to try and improve them for good.
Rafaela Chapman plays Vesper. What is it about her performance that allows the audience to see Vesper as a strong character?
I think ultimately, Vesper, as a 13-year-old, has seen it all. She is traumatized beyond her years. There's so much death and decay in this world. Her mother has disappeared. We never find out what happens to her, I don't think. And she's still going strong. She's very headstrong. Her father, who I mentioned, has a disability and uses a drone to talk with her, is often trying to catch up with her because she's running around all over the place and she's doing her experiments. And poor daddy only has enough battery to last a certain amount of time. But he does try and keep tabs on his daughter whenever he can. I think a strong character is someone who is, you know, fearless, someone who is willing to take risks, someone who cares for others. And I think we see all that here.
Along those lines, Michael, in terms of developing and showing characters, how can writers develop characters that people will relate to?
That's a good question. I think the most important thing to do is to ensure that the character has multiple interests. I think sometimes characters are very one-dimensional and are easy to forget. But for me, Vesper stands out because I can see that she loves her father, that she has a passion for biohacking and genetics, that she honestly wants to make the world a better place, and that she is fearless when it comes to fighting for her rights and what she believes in. So that's just, to me, something that I relate to and something that I was happy to see on camera. I think sometimes there's a tendency for a lot of women characters to be simplified and, you know, just to have a one-track mind about getting revenge or finding the perfect date. And this character avoids all those tropes.
Broadly speaking, this movie is identified as science fiction, but more specifically, it's a new form of sci-fi called climate fiction, or cli-fi, that deal with the effects of climate change. That would typically imply a movie has quite a bit of doom and gloom. Are there any positive aspects about Vesper's setting?
I think that's one of my criticisms, is that unfortunately there's not really a lot of positivity in this film. There is a good scene towards the middle of the film where Vesper is asking someone about what different animals sound like. And they do make the sounds, they make the sound effects, and there's a chunk about a parrot always repeating what the other person says. So they repeat each other for a while. I think that's fun, but ultimately, I think I don't want to live in this kind of mood. I think with all this doom and gloom, I think sometimes we need to find a world that we would actually want to live in and try and aspire to be in that world. Because in this world that Vesper lives in, I think people would only be happy after 100 or 200 years of social change. And I think that's just depressing for me, especially when we have our own issues going on in this world.
Michael, I was so impressed with the way that you explained what this movie is about, even though you acknowledged it's a little bit complicated. How can a science fiction writer create a rich world or a rich universe without overwhelming an audience?
I think ultimately you need to focus on world building itself. I think sometimes, like you mentioned, that this story is a bit complicated. I think sometimes you may need more time to sit with the world and to understand the world, to try and see if there's any good things happening in the world that would make it somewhat, you know, motivating to live in. So to that end, some critics have said that this film may have been better off as a miniseries. And I think that may be true. I think it would be nice to, you know, learn more about the world and not have it, you know, crash down on you all at once. So I think ultimately with the world building, you want to try and feel like you can live in this world, you can understand how the world works. There were times in this film where I was a bit confused about how the world was working or how the different classes were functioning together in this world. And so I think ultimately you would want to ensure that everybody has a clear understanding of the principles that have created this world in the first place and why and how it got to be this way.
You've told me before that Eddie Marsan is one of your favorite actors. What did you make of his performance?
Well, he plays Uncle Chosen. And he is just an evil, evil, evil man. He probably runs a whorehouse, for lack of a better word, and he sacrifices his children to ensure that they can donate blood for genetic modification. So I think he's really hitting all the evil aspects here. He also tries to strangle 13-year-olds, which is never a good look. I think anytime you need a bad guy, call Eddie Marsan, just ring him up on the telephone. He also plays good guys, but as a bad guy, he's very conniving. What's interesting, though, is that he's the brother of the father with a disability. So there's a little bit of interaction with the disability and that kind of relationship that he may have, or attention that he may have on siblings when one of them has a disability. But ultimately, there's always so much time you have in a movie, and it may have been better to have a miniseries to explore some of these dynamics, especially with all the bad things that Eddie Marsan's character is said to be doing.
Michael, final thought here. What would you rate this movie, Vesper, out of 10?
I think I would rate it a strong 70%. I think it's still worth looking into, but I can completely understand if people are burned out of post-apocalyptic landscapes. I wish that there was a little bit more color. I wish that there was more time to have the story be told and for us to understand the different classes. Because that's something I didn't mention in this review yet, is that there's slaves, there's automatons, there's the droids. There's the children that donate blood. There's people like Vesper, and then there's the elite classes that take advantage of everyone. So it's a lot to unpack in an hour and 45 minutes, especially when you're starting fresh with a new world. I think, unfortunately, that's probably why we have a tendency to see not very original projects. We see a lot of series, we see a lot of sequels. That's because they're still building the world from the first film. So in some ways, this film probably may get a sequel to continue building the world, but that's just because we don't have enough time to understand it within an hour and a half. So I think it's worth checking out if you have the time and the patience.
Michael, thank you for this.
Thank you, and have a wonderful day, and try not to take blood from anybody who doesn't want to give it to you.
I'll do my best, Michael, but I'll tell you this. By the next time you and I hang out, I will very likely have seen the new John Wick movie, so I'm very much excited for that.
Ooh, yes. Have you seen all three of them before this one?
I have, yes. That's one of the reasons why I'm so excited.
That's amazing. I think you'll find it. It's amazing. I think it's been 100% from all my colleagues.
Oof.
I think people are, again, you know, this is one of those rare examples where a series is still doing well in the fourth time around.
Absolutely. Well, maybe you and I will get a chance to chat about that one down the road. If not, I'll do one of my one-sentence movie reviews next week. Michael, have a great day. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, YouTube.
That's entertainment critic Michael McNeely. You can find Vesper for rent on Amazon or Apple. Coming up after the break, we assemble the round table. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Nazreen Abdelmajid and Rami Amethan are standing by. But Alex Smythe, do you want to dive into something a little bit deeper in this roundtable conversation?
Yeah, Dave, that's right. It's a bit more of a heavier topic for the roundtable than we usually cover. But it was something that I've been dealing with a family member for a while now. So I have a family member who's dealing with a long-term medical issue, and we've been trying to get help and assistance on tackling that issue. But it seems every single step of the process has just been filled with either slow response or incompetent, whether it's help or service, or just overall lack of poor medical supports. And we're still looking for answers and still seeking other opinions because we're not satisfied with the level of care that we've been able to get so far. So I really wanted to open this up to the panel because for myself, I have a lot of experience personally dealing with medical professionals, and I'm sure everyone else on the panel and roundtable does as well. So, Nisreen, let's start with you. Like, how do you deal when you in? How do you deal with it when you receive poor medical service? Whether it's opinions that you don't quite fully trust, or it's just very slow and ineffective supports when you finally do get a hold of someone.
I think I have to be honest here, open book here. I've slowly given up as I grew up. So I, in the beginning, when I moved to adult care instead of being in sick kids, it was very difficult to adjust and getting used to adult care being, you know, doctors sometimes just giving you the straightforward answer or not checking on you. And I've had doctors where I would complain, okay, this particular thing hurts. Okay, here, pop some pills. Let's increase the dose and go for it. And I'm just like, I need more. I need more attention in that case. So I think it's very important. But I think over the years, I've slowly kind of drifted apart from that. So if they tell me, okay, you're not going to get your vision back in your left eye, and everybody's telling me, okay, get us a second opinion. I did. In Canada, I did. I got second and third opinion. So that was the only thing that I kind of reached out and said, okay, I should get more opinions on this particular topic. But in general, I just kind of go with it. And I wish I didn't have to. But I think that's in this day and age, I think, especially living here, it's very difficult to be like, okay, let me get more opinions.
Yeah, Alex, I don't think I've got a particularly cheery answer or proactive answer for you either, yeah. Because it took me 4 years to get any kind of semblance of care on the tumors that were on my vocal cords. And what finally prompted it one day was coughing up a whole bunch of blood and going to the emergency room. Until there was crisis, there was no action taken by the medical system in this province. Mm-hmm. And in the end, I had to go out of province to finally get my care, which is what I was able to do. And thankfully it was in Canada, and that was in the end covered by the province of Ontario. But Alex, what you're describing is likely an interaction with specialists. And when it takes 18 to 20 to 24 months to actually see a specialist, how discerning can you actually be? Ramya, I don't know what your experience is on this front.
Honestly, with some of my family members, we have gone through hell trying to figure out a diagnosis, B, like where to get the care, C, where to even go for a second opinion, what that looks like. I mean, honestly, the most we've gotten is to talk to friends, talk to people we know and like explain what's going on, or just even in just conversation, finding out what other people have done, and then go from there, right? So discussing, just sometimes even casually, to say, you know, these are the symptoms I'm experiencing, or I've had this for so long, do you know what I'm talking about? And then others saying, oh my God, you should go here, go there, try this, try that, and potentially move the needle forward with the, trying to get some specialized help. But other than that, we've found more often than not, I'm not going to say all the time, but more often than not, similar to Nisreen, what you're saying, which is just medication, simple Band-Aid fixes, and, you know, this is your situation. This is it. There's nowhere to go from here. And I find that to be very, very discouraging. I think that we do have more resources than we sometimes even realize, just because of the tone, the attitude, the way that information is portrayed to you. You would think that this is the end of the line.
Alex, I don't think you got much closure from your question here today, because it's a pretty grim picture being painted by the three of us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but this is the reality of it. And I would probably hazard a guess that, you know, this, based on everyone's responses, this isn't something that is recent or impacted because of the COVID pandemic, which has been used as a excuse to broad stroke the medical field and our healthcare system as being overworked. Like, these are things that have been in place and have been issues prior to that. I mean, even for myself, like, I went to an optometrist for over a decade, and I constantly complained about all my symptoms that I experienced, my peripheral vision dropping, my color differentials weakening, my night vision disappearing. And they would look in my eye, and they never could even figure out RP, let alone Usher syndrome, with the fact that I wore hearing aids, and I've always worn hearing aids when I've been. But as soon as I went to another medical professional, someone who was a specialist, because it was getting really bad, within 3 minutes they were able to diagnose me without even looking at my eye, just based on a conversation. So I think this is also the challenge I face, where it's, you don't know you're receiving poor medical care or medical advice until you find someone who's giving you proper care, proper advice, proper consultation. It's when you find the good doctors and support that you realize you've been dealing with bad support for years in some instances.
Let's wrap up.
Can I add, Alex?
Yeah, please go, Nisreen.
Sorry, I was just going to add, I'm so glad you brought up the COVID situation. So even before COVID, it was a bad situation. And I think over the years for COVID, you would get, you know, just to kind of have a, not even an appointment, just a consultation of what you're looking for takes about over 12 months to see somebody. Yeah. And it could be something big. And I remember it took me forever to check out my ankle. And they were saying that the wait list for just getting a procedure done is 4 years. And yeah, I couldn't walk on it for a long time. Yeah. So it's gotten so much worse. And I think, Dave, you have a point. I think if it's not an emergency, they're not going to look at you. And that's why even when I go to my doctor and I tell her, okay, I'm in this much pain, she gives me pills, and I've gotten this response so many times. If it gets worse, if you're still in pain, go to the emergency room.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, guys, a lot of negativity here. Let's see if we can actually wrap on a bit of a positive. I'm ashamed to admit I cannot remember the name of the doctor who eventually led me to the ENT specialist that I went to out of province, but I do recall the name of the specialist out of province who did the surgery and the diagnosis. Dr. Karen Cost in Montreal saved my life and saved my career, and I owe everything I have today to her, and I'm grateful every day to Dr. Karen Cost. Alex, one doctor, one professional you want to shout out?
Yeah, I'll actually give two. So Dr. Elise Ian, who is based out of St. Mike's and SickKids,
yeah,
who's been overseeing my vision the last 10 years or so. She's been phenomenal. And then even my new general practitioner, Dr. Elisa Krantz, who literally called me back after I went and saw her on Monday for an eye issue. She called me back to follow up and just see how I was doing. I've never had that before.
Ramya, doctor or a medical professional you want to shout out?
For my personal experience, Dr. Elise Ion, as Alex pointed out, she has made the world of a difference for so many people with my condition, living in Ontario, living in Canada, living in the US, and she's just grinding away trying to make sure that we're all supported and taken care of. And ophthalmology aside, I'd say for family members of mine, the medical team at Sunnybrook in like various departments, but really at Sunnybrook, they have taken such good care, and like the what do you call it, the nursing staff and all the other support system that we have there have always been genuinely amazing to my family.
Nazreen, I know you've had a lot of bad experiences, but who do you want to shout out for a good experience?
I'm shouting out my former rheumatologist, Dr. Laxer from Sick Kids Hospital, because right when I was two years old, he diagnosed me right away on the spot. He knew exactly what I needed, what I needed care for, and he was the best.
Right on. Alex, Nazreen, thank you for this. Ramya, just before you say goodbye, I've only got about 30 seconds for you here, but what's coming up on Kelly and Ramya today, 2 p.m. Eastern time on AMI Audio and AMI TV?
Most important thing, Spotify. You can listen to your audiobooks there now. So that's really cool news. We'll talk about it on the app update with John Buehler and get more deep into it with Ryan Hui on the China Bookshelf.
Yeah, that is really cool news to be getting the audiobooks on Spotify. That $10 a month is getting more and more valuable. Mm-hmm. Ramya, thank you for this.
Thank you, Dave.
That is Ramya Amuthan, the co-host of Kelly and Ramya, coming your way 2 p.m. Eastern time on AMI. Coming up next, Karen McKay from the Center for Equitable Library Access will stop by to highlight the Lambda Literary Awards and tell you about a couple new books in the Sela collection. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. The Lambda Literary Award nominations came out this week. These awards recognize works from LGBTQ plus writers. Karen McKay is the communications manager at the Center for Equitable Library Access and is here to offer you up a few more details. Hey, good morning, Karen.
Good morning. It's great to see you.
Yeah, nice to spend a little bit of time with you on a Friday. Always a great way to head into the weekend. Karen, what are some of the categories that are part of the Lambda Awards?
There are 25 categories. I'm not going to list them all, but they have lesbian, gay fiction, transgender fiction. They have LGBTQ plus books for young adults, middle school, and children, all fiction categories. And then they also have nonfiction, memoir, poetry, and drama. So it really covers the full gamut.
Wow, the full swath of literature for writers out there. What's at stake for some of these writers? What can they pick up with a big win?
So they're all different prize amounts depending on the categories. They range from, you know, modest amounts of sort of 1500 up to, I think it's 10,000 for the major categories. I think part of it is just the recognition and the validation that these writers and these stories get to take up the important space they deserve in our communities.
So what's the process now? When are the winners going to be announced?
It'll be announced in mid-June. They haven't actually announced the final date for that yet, but it's usually mid-June. And for the past couple of years, you've been able to watch the gala online. I don't know whether they're planning to do that again this year or not, but it's always a lot of fun. If you love this sort of writing and this part of the community, then it's a great opportunity to spend a night celebrating the authors that make a real difference.
Karen, I know it might be difficult to try and put together a collection from 25 different categories, but what kind of representation shows up from these awards inside the Sela collection?
We have about 70 of the titles right now, and there's more coming in. Some of them are newer releases, so we'll be putting those in as quickly as we can. And we've got a number of Canadians on the list, which is really great to see.
Oh, excellent. Karen, I know I've asked you this before, but remind me, how do awards like this end up guiding and shaping the kind of choices Sela makes about what gets added to the library?
Well, for this award in particular, it really represents a very broad range of authors and own stories. And so it's one that we pay special attention to. We try and make sure that we have all of the major Canadian awards shortlisted in at least. And we try and make sure that we get as many young adult and kids awards in as well, just to make sure that we have a really broad range of choices. There's a lot of awards. There was another new one announced just a week ago through the Writers Trust. And so there's more and more awards, which makes our job both exciting and a bit challenging to make sure that those books are available for people who want to read them.
As someone who tries to report on the news every day, yes, the perpetual cycle can make it quite difficult. All right, Karen, one of the overarching themes here when I chat with you about featured selections is we always end up running out of time. So I know you've got four on the docket today. So let's be mindful of time right from the start. 90 seconds each. The first one you want to talk about here, well, all of these are new additions to the Sela collection. So the first one is On the Ravine by Vincent Lam.
So folks may not be aware of Vincent Lam. His parents emigrated from Vietnam and he was born in London, Ontario. He's a medical doctor and he's still practicing and writing books on the side. So when he releases a book, it's a real treat for his fans. He's not the most prolific writer. This is his fifth book, On the Ravine, and it follows the story of Dr. Chen, who practices in Toronto. And like many other cities, Toronto's facing a fentanyl crisis, a toxic drug supply issue, and a record number of deaths. And this is haunting Dr. Chen. He thinks a lot about the what ifs. What if he'd done more or less? What if he'd done something different? Would his patients still be alive? And then he encounters Claire, who's a violinist, and she feels really at one with her music, but she's now addicted to opioids and she's becoming increasingly reckless. And after two overdoses in 24 hours, she ends up meeting Dr. Chen. And they really connect. He really is very drawn to her more deeply with the complexities of the parent, or sorry, the doctor-patient relationship. And so he begins to sort of contemplate the implications of that and his intentions in treating this particular patient. So all of these what-ifs are sort of ringing in his mind, and he has to contemplate how far he'll go to save a patient. It's a gripping novel. It's very emotionally forceful, and it's from a really fantastic Canadian writer who's covering topics that aren't often included in our conversations. So I highly recommend this one. This is one of our collections development person's favorite books.
Oh, wow. Karen, I know this next one on the list is one that's turned a lot of heads in the literary world of late, Bad Cree by Jessica Johns.
It has. There's been a lot of buzz about this book. So Jessica Johns is a member of the Sucker Cree First Nations in Treaty 8 territory in northern Alberta. And this is her first published novel. The main character, Mackenzie, has extremely vivid and often very disturbing dreams. And one morning she wakes up with a severed crow head in her hands and she panics. Only moments earlier, she'd been fending off masses of birds in a snow-covered forest. And then she blinks and the head disappears and she realizes it was a dream. Almost every night, her dreams return her to memories from before her sister Sabrina died at a lakefront campsite. And Mackenzie feels immense grief. Her dreams start closing in on her real life. She is stalked by a murder of crows around the city. She wakes up from a dream about drowning and she's throwing up water. And then she gets threatening text messages from somebody claiming to be Sabrina after a dream about Sabrina. This is more than she can handle, so she decides to travel home to her family in Alberta. But she's been feeling increasingly disconnected from them as the guilt and the grief sort of envelops this family. Her family welcomes her back, but it makes her feel really more alone. So the story explores what really happened the night at the lake. What did it have to do with Sabrina's death? And Jessica feels like only a bad Cree would put her family at risk by bringing her dreams back to them. This is a story that pulls you in fast. It does not let go. It's incredibly gripping. She is an excellent storyteller. It's a very female-focused story, which is kind of refreshing. There's no romance. It's all about family and culture, history and growth, self-discovery, and Mackenzie's journey to sort of confront the legacy of violence on her family and her community and the land that they are calling home. Excellent book, very well reviewed.
Karen, I love the title of this next one, Tell Me Pleasant Things About Immortality by Lindsay Wong.
So Lindsay Wong is a best-selling author. She wrote The Woo Woo, which was a finalist for Canada Reads in 2019, and she's written a young adult novel called My Summer of Love. This book is her third book. It is darkly hilarious. It's a poignant collection of immigrant horror stories. They will haunt you and consume you in very unsettling ways. So the short story genre allows Lindsay Wong to really take a freedom in exploring these different stories and different characters. She intertwines horror and supernatural and mythology to with her lens on BIPOC experience. And so the characters in the stories are really interesting. There's a courtesan from the 17th century China who tries, she might, just can't manage to die. There's a grandmother Wu who returns from the dead to protect her grandchildren from bullies. There's a story about an internet bride who inadvertently brings the apocalypse to a Nebraska city, and a story about Mr. Grow, who on his 65th birthday, surrounded by his family, he becomes possessed by the spirit of Mimi, an exotic dancer who he'd murdered 2 days before.
Oh my gosh.
She really has some very creative stories in here. They explore all kinds of interesting ideas. Living forever isn't everything it's cracked up to be. Hearts can still break and money still matters even in eternity. Vanity and love and tragedy are all explored. Unfulfilled desires of the dead are echoed in the lives of modern day immigrants. The stories are often deeply disturbing at the same time as they're being hilariously funny. And so the collection really is about what transformations and what makes us human, really. The reviews are fantastic for this book. So if this is the kind of thing that you might be intrigued by, I highly recommend picking it up.
Karen, unfortunately, no time to go in depth on this last one. The Mountain of Master of Shatin, an Ava Lee novel, book 12 by Ian Hamilton. So maybe just give me 15 seconds on why someone should check this one out.
He's a well-regarded reader. This is the book 12 in a series that began with The Water Rat of Wan Chi. It's about Ava Lee, who's a Chinese-Canadian lesbian forensic accountant, and she manages to find trouble along with huge amounts of missing money. Excellent book, very captivating.
That was excellent, Karen. Karen, thank you for always helping us build a great reading list going into the weekend. We'll talk to you again in a couple weeks. Actually, no, we won't. It's Good Friday in a couple weeks. We'll talk to you in a month.
Wonderful. Have a great month then.
That's it. That's Karen McKay, the communications manager for the Center for Equitable Library Access. That's all the time we have for the show today. We're back again Monday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern time. Until then, I'm Dave Brown reminding you to play safe, play fair, but don't forget to have some fun. Let's say thank you to the people who've worked their tails off to put this show together this week.
Host, Dave Brown. Co-host, producer, Alex Smythe. Sports reporter, Brock Richardson. Contributors, Rami Ambuthan, Nazreen Abdel-Majid. Senior show producer, Andrika Delanerol. Visual producer, Bruce McClarion. Producers, Paul Daniel, Marianne Dion-Jones. Production assistant, Kingsley Juco. Director, Anastasia Spalding-Stenhouse. Control room operators, Daniel Panamondo, Eliza Rocco, Parker Oxtoby. Manager of Operations, Kyle Harper. Manager of Live Production, Paula Deneen. Director of Content Development, Kara Nye. Vice President of Programming, John Melville. President and CEO, David Arrington. Give us your feedback, 1-866-509-4545. Copyright 2023, Accessible Media, Inc.
An AMI original production.
Hey, Dave Brown here. If you enjoy this podcast portion of our show, remember you can watch it live every day at 9 a.m. Eastern time on AMI TV.
Hi, I'm Ramya Amuthan. Join me weekly for AMI Audiobook Review, the podcast that explores new titles, introduces us to famous narrators, and updates what's hot at the Center for Equitable Library Access. Download episodes of AMI Audiobook Review from your favorite podcast provider.